DR Power Equipment is the industry leader in field and brush mowers. Their full line of machines are designed to clear acres of tough weeds, woody brush, and saplings up to 3 inches thick, hour after hour, year after year. Just one mow, and you'll agree nothing stops at DR. Visit drpower.com to learn more and shop the sale today.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchteroin, Argus, Akoiza.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, regime change in England after the death of Queen Elizabeth I, the struggle for LGBTQ rights in Ireland over the past 50 years, and to end the show, the making of Irish New York in the years after the Great Potato Famine. And we begin tonight's show with the regime change from Elizabeth I to James I as we look at what happened as Britain moved from Tudor to Stuart. Queen Elizabeth I was a hard act to follow for James I, a Scottish newcomer who faced a host of problems in his first years as king. Not only the ghost of his predecessor and her legacy, but also unrest in Ireland, serious questions about his legitimacy on the English throne, and even plots to remove him, most famously the Gunpowder Plot of 1605. Contrary to traditional assumptions, James's accession was by no means a smooth one, and a new book tells the story of the dramatic accession and first decade of the reign of King James I. The book is called From Tudor to Stuart, The Regime Change from Elizabeth I to James I. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press. The author is Susan Dorn, and Susan, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Well, thank you very much indeed for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Why was there controversy about the accession of James I? Was he a legitimate king? Was he the rightful heir to the throne?
Well, by bloodline, yes, he was. He was descended from Margaret, who was the older sister of Henry VII. But there were certain problems attached to his title. One is that he was a foreigner. Scotland was a foreign country, and foreigners were not in law, able to inherit English property. And the question was, did that also apply to the crown? And that was a legal debate that was going on throughout Elizabeth's reign, because Mary, Queen of Scots, of course, laid a claim to the succession, Mary being James's mother. Additionally, there was the problem of Henry VIII's will. Henry VIII's will did not exclude the Scottish line, but didn't mention the Scottish line, and instead mentioned the descendants of Henry VIII's younger sister, who was Mary. And so legally, there were question marks. And because Elizabeth did not name a successor, because there was no Act of Parliament which laid down the succession after Elizabeth, other than that Henry's will should be followed, there were all sorts of question marks about James's right to accede.
Although they tried to claim that Elizabeth on her deathbed had kind of nominated him or named him.
Yes, this is repeated quite a lot during the early years of James's reign. It's questionable because there are accounts that Elizabeth couldn't say a word in her last days, but she was said to have effectively nominated James as her heir. There is another story, which seems more likely, but I think very much stage produced, that Elizabeth lifted her head and either lifted her hands to portray a crown over her head when James's name was mentioned. But I suspect there was a certain amount of manipulating her hands at that moment.
And why were there so many plots then to try and remove him, most famously with the Gunpowder Plot? Was it that you could then change the succession and maybe have a Catholic monarch on the throne?
Well, certainly the aim of two plots was to have either a Catholic monarch on the throne in the case of the Gunpowder Plot, or to force James to become in some ways a prisoner of the Catholics. And that was in the by-plot. The main plot, which is a bit murky, we're not really sure how far it was indeed a plot, that was intended to be put into action was again intended to remove James. So why were there so many plots? Well, the Catholics were terribly disappointed with James. They had hoped for better times. After all, he was the son of a Catholic martyr, Mary Queen of Scots, and they thought that at the very least he would provide them with a better degree of toleration. And given that his wife was, it was hinted at, and certainly was true, that she had converted from being a Lutheran to being a Catholic, there were also hopes that James himself might convert over time once he felt secure on the English throne. Those sort of hopes and expectations were soon dispelled, and that resulted in the attempts to remove him. Who would be on the throne instead of him? Well, in the case of the bi plot, probably they were thinking, and the main plot, they were thinking of Arbella Stuart, whose religious beliefs were really not known, and they thought she could be manipulated as she was seen as being a rather weak character. And the other, the gunpowder plot, there was to be not only the blowing up of the House of Parliament and all the Protestant establishment, but also a Midlands rising. And that would result in Princess Elizabeth, who was very young at the time, being rescued, in quotation marks, brought down to London and crowned as Elizabeth II, of course, with Catholics all around her.
And of course, Ireland is causing some major headaches as well, and there's considerable unrest here.
Yes, and in some ways that's surprising, because the last year had been devastating for Ireland. The rebellion or the war, depending on which side you're on, that was led by Hugh O'Neill, Earl of Tyrone, had been defeated. And Lord Mountjoy, the Queen's lieutenant, had devastated the northern part of Ireland, and indeed the south as well. And so it looked as if there wasn't much spunk left in Ireland, you know, for any kind of resistance. But no sooner was it announced that James was going to be the new king, that Elizabeth had died, then there started to be quite difficult to detect exactly what they wanted, but there started to be disturbances in the southern part of Ireland. There were Catholics coming out into the open. It was around Easter time, and the rituals associated with Easter, which were banned, were now being carried through. And in some places, Cork, Waterford, there was a refusal to allow the new king's representatives to come in. What they actually wanted is really not very clear. My own guess is that they were prepared to accept James. They thought that he almost certainly was a Catholic, or if he wasn't, he would almost certainly become a Catholic. Misplaced hopes again, but that they wanted to show the strength of Catholicism in Ireland in order to make him realise that there may have been a defeat at the hands of Mountjoy, but the Catholics were strong and behind a change in regime which would bring again Catholicism tolerated in the Irish realm.
What about James's wife, Anne of Denmark, or Anna? And she seems a fascinating figure, and again, someone who's been much kind of mythologized, and a huge amount of kind of theories and ideas and speculation about her.
Yeah, she is a fascinating character. I mean, there have been two views, polar opposite views about Anna. Originally, she was thought of as an airhead, you know, someone who just spent James's money on jewels and clothes and masks, and that essentially she was just there to enjoy herself after a rather grim time in Scotland. But then the kind of attitude towards her went through a 360-degree change. And she was then seen as a sort of proto-feminist, that her masks were critical of James, that in some ways she was almost a subversive figure. She was, for example, the patron of a theatrical company in Blackfriars, which produced plays that really got into trouble with the regime because they satirised James and his Scottish favourites. So there was this kind of two opposite pictures of Anna. Now, I choose a third view of Anna, And I won't say it's a middle view, but she's certainly not an airhead. And she's also not subversive. To my mind, she is the epitome of what a queen regnant should be. She operates as someone in support of her husband, supporting his political views, which accorded with her own. So, for example, she was pro-peace with Spain in 1603-4. She wanted a Spanish marriage, a Catholic marriage for Henry, which, you know, James was happy to go ahead with, providing there was a large enough dowry. And all her masks were designed to show the splendor of the Stuart regime, and all her spending on clothes and jewels were also designed to show the magnificence of the Jacobean court. And so Anna is a figure, an important political figure, but she's not a subversive one. So, for example, although she is a Catholic, she doesn't play the role of supporting Catholics in the way that Charles I's wife did, Henrietta Maria, who was also a Catholic. And she kept her Catholicism pretty much under wraps, so that quite a lot of people didn't even know that she was a Catholic.
I love your subtitle, The Regime Change from Elizabeth I to James I. And that idea of regime change, there's a change of personnel. Is there also a change of policies? And to what extent is this a significant change of regime?
Yes. I mean, this is the question that I grappled with. And of course, there's no easy answer. So in quite a number of respects, there's continuity. And in some ways, there's continuity in ways that historians in the past have, I don't think, fully recognized. So I argue, and you can have heard already, that James's policy towards Catholics really doesn't change from Elizabeth. Of course, there are fewer martyrdoms, there are fewer executions, but times changed. I mean, Elizabeth's executions mainly took place during the war against Spain, when the Catholics were seen as being a third column. There's peace under James. Now, I don't think either James or Elizabeth were keen to be persecutors, but they found themselves in a position where they needed to uphold the law, and James was as prepared to do that as Elizabeth. In addition to Protestant zealots that we call Puritans, they both take the same line. They insist that they can't go their own way and ignore parts of the Elizabethan prayer book that they don't like, and not wear their surplices and not do the cross at baptism. They insist, both of them equally, that there needs to be complete conformity. Only turn a blind eye when it's absolutely necessary. But certainly on the surface, the policy is one that everybody has to use the Elizabethan prayer book. And I don't think that's been fully appreciated. There's a purge of ministers under James, Protestant ministers under James, which is at least as long a list as that under Elizabeth. So we're not seeing any changes there. It could be said we see a change because James brings an end to the war with Spain. I think Elizabeth would have liked to have brought an end to the war. And certainly what we see in James's policy towards Spain is a renewal, if you like, of Elizabeth's policy towards Spain in the 1570s, before the war breaks out, which is a kind of rapprochement, not appeasement. James is not, as some historians in the past have thought, an appeaser, because he's not going to give up Virginia because the Spanish don't like it. You know, he continues to back the English colony in America. And at the same time, he is prepared to send troops to Germany when there is a disputed succession in the states of Ulick-Cleves in order to support the Protestant candidate. So we're not seeing an appeaser. We are seeing very much someone who is cautious, careful, knowing the importance of keeping Spain on side and not wanting to spend money that England really didn't have without having to impose almost intolerable burdens on the subjects, which is dangerous, that's why his policy is really not so different from Elizabeth's. But where I think you do see differences lies in what I call the political culture. James wanted a union with Scotland. And that was not only unpopular, but it raised all kinds of constitutional questions. And it resulted in James not only having very tense relations with his parliaments, but also making statements which led historians later on to call him an absolutist. It's a very heavy divine right of kings. Elizabeth probably believed in these things that James was saying, but would never say it. And the result of that is that you start getting a tension along constitutional lines. Now, I'm not suggesting for a moment that we're in a high road to civil war and that what happens under Charles is the seeds are there under James. But what I am suggesting is that there is a different political atmosphere, both in Parliament and amongst the political classes that you can see in the press, you can see in polemic, which is arising, I think, not least because of the union debates, which clearly wouldn't and didn't happen under Elizabeth, and also perhaps because of the high expenditure of James's court. And the high expenditure is not just on clothes and jewels or masks, but it's on pensions and gifts. James has a largesse that Elizabeth simply doesn't. Elizabeth instinctively is not generous. James instinctively is. And politically, he feels he has to be. He has to reward his Scots who have come down to England with him, because otherwise they can't have the lifestyle that will make them equal to their English counterparts. And if he wants union, there has to be an Anglo-Scottish court, and that's what he wants. So politically and instinctively, James is a big spender, and that really does create new problems as well as an intensification of old ones, which to my mind results in a shift in political culture during the early and indeed throughout the Jacobean years.
And of course, it leads to new colonies as well in Virginia, absolutely, named, of course, Jamestown. And this is a time of expansion.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we always think of Elizabeth as the imperialist, as, you know, there's Raleigh and Drake and the rest, but they don't actually secure any colonies at all. Roanoke is a failure. But under James, you've got something very different. And initially, of course, you have Virginia. After that, it's not a Jacobean venture, but you have the New England colonies that begin. And in addition to that, you have the plantations in Ireland. Let's go back to Ireland. And what's, I think, would never have happened under Elizabeth is that those plantations are Anglo-Scottish, that the Scots are given a lot of the land. And of course, they're the Presbyterian Scots. So you can see how some of the problems in present-day Ulster can be traced back to James's reign, even more than to Elizabeth's reign.
Well, it's a brilliant new study. It's called From Tudor to Stuart, The Regime Change from Elizabeth I to James I. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press. The author is Susan Dorn. And Susan, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
DR Power Equipment is the industry leader in field and brush mowers. Their full line of machines are designed to clear acres of tough weeds, woody brush, and saplings up to 3 inches thick, hour after hour, year after year. Just one mow, and you'll agree nothing stops a DR. Visit drpower.com to learn more and shop the sale today.
Welcome back to Talking History. Uncovering the gripping narrative of Irish immigrants who transformed America in the aftermath of the Great Famine, a new book exposes the grit and resilience of the famine Irish in New York, defying hardship to redefine the American dream. The book is called Plentiful Country, The Great Potato Famine and the Making of Irish New York. It's published in hardback by Eru. The author is Tyler Anbinder. And Tyler, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Can we begin with this great idea in the book? Because we normally have this idea of the immigrants landing in New York, enduring poverty, suffering, you know, not really settling in or being welcomed. But your study shows how, despite all of the obstacles, despite everything they faced and the discrimination and so on, they were actually able to rise up and become successful and make something of this new life for themselves.
Exactly. The famine Irish arrive in New York with more obstacles to their success than any immigrants who had ever landed in America. They're not only the poorest immigrants who had ever arrived in New York, but they're the least educated. They bring the least capital with them. And so Americans feel like there's no way they can ever succeed in the United States. But the Irish do. And I find this over and over again as I looked at the lives of the famine immigrants. In part, this is because, you know, the famine immigrants are mostly young. You don't just get a cross-section of Ireland coming to America. It's mostly people who are young in their teens, 20s. And so they had a lot of energy despite all the obstacles they faced. And they also had a lot of ambition. And so even though they start out in dreary jobs as day laborers, as porters, you know, digging the canals, building the railroads, they have ambition. They see all the opportunities that exist in the United States that hadn't existed for them in Ireland, and they take advantage of them, and they start businesses, and they get training to get better jobs, and they end up doing quite well.
And you've got some wonderful archival sources that you've used for it, including the archives of the Emigrant Savings Bank, because that gives us a real insight into how they were able to, through hard work and through everything, how they were able to finance this new life then as well.
Yes. In 1850, Irish Americans who had come before the famine set up the Emigrant Savings Bank specifically for the famine Irish in order to encourage them to save, to create a savings bank run by the Irish so that the newcomers in an era before deposit insurance would feel safe putting their money in a bank. But in those days, there's no government-issued identification of any kind, and the bank was afraid that criminals would come and steal other people's money by pretending to be them. So the bank created a database, handwritten in leather-bound ledgers, of information about each depositor, very detailed. And I was able to use that information to track the famine immigrants. The reason we hadn't known how they had done in America before was because so many of them had the same name that it was impossible to track them for 10 or 20 years, because we could never know if one Michael Kelly was the same Michael Kelly we might see 10 or 20 years later in a different place doing something else. But the bank records have so much detail about each depositor, including their parents' names, their mother's maiden name. It's the first business ever to use mother's maiden name as a security question. And we're able, therefore, to track the immigrants. And I track thousands of them and then use that information to help paint this collective portrait of the famine Irish in the United States.
So what kind of jobs, what types of jobs were the Irish taking, and what jobs were they able to get?
So when the famine Irish first arrive in New York, the women are overwhelmingly becoming domestic servants. There was a huge, you know, the United States was all, even back then, quite wealthy, and Americans could afford to have household help, but couldn't find people to do that work. And the famine Irish women stepped into that role. And so 70% of the women worked as domestic servants. Mostly they left those jobs when they got married, though. In terms of men, day labor was an important starting off job. That was doing construction work, right? Anything you see on a construction site today being done by a machine was done back then by the Irish. So digging the foundations, hauling all the materials to the site, hauling away all the debris and rubble, hoisting the bricks and the mortar up. As the building grew higher and higher, was all done by hand and legs and all done by the Irish. But as those construction workers saved money, they used that money to start businesses. And so groceries were a huge business for the famine Irish. Saloons were a very big business. The Irish who came to America, for the most part, hadn't been able to afford alcohol in Ireland, but they could in America. And so they opened thousands and thousands of saloons. And the Irish became known for their saloons. And of course, the Irish immigrants patronized those saloons.
And how much prejudice and opposition and discrimination did they face?
Oh, they faced a terrible amount of discrimination and prejudice. There are the famous advertisements in newspapers that said, "No Irish need apply." And of course, those are only the tip of the iceberg, because most newspapers refused to run those ads. So even the hundreds that we know did run tell us that the discrimination must have been quite fierce. A lot of employers just wouldn't hire the Irish at all. no matter their qualifications, no matter how desperate they were for workers. Sometimes it was because they were Irish. Sometimes it was because they were Catholic. The United States back then was a very Protestant nation. And many Americans believed that the reason the United States was so successful was because of its Protestant religious beliefs. And so between being Irish and being Catholic, many Americans refused to deal with the famine Irish. And that's one of the reasons, actually, in the end, that the Irish succeed is because they start so many businesses because they won't be hired by native-born Americans. But it turns out starting a business, if you succeed, is a great way to make a success in the United States. And then those business owners, because they have discrimination, couldn't invest in some other things that, that native-born Americans might have. So they invested their earnings in American real estate. And that turned out to be a great investment. And that's what helped, another thing that helped the Irish do so well.
How many go into business and how many go into things like the police? And do we have a sense of the numbers of those who are getting involved as clerks or grocers? Or I know you have figures for some who became watchmakers and peddlers, and then others go into other professions.
Sure. Well, when they start out in America, about half the famine Irish men are doing unskilled work like day labor or being porters, longshoremen, things like that. And about another third are artisans, shoemakers, carpenters, things like that. But after 10 or 20 years in America, those numbers changed. And by 20 years in America, only about a quarter of the famine Irish men are still doing day labor and such. And about a third of them own their own businesses. And another 10% are clerks, as you mentioned. And so as a result, by about after 20 years in America, about 45% of the famine Irish now have white collar jobs, which is quite surprising. And then in terms of saloon keepers, that was actually the most popular business for a famine Irish immigrant to open. And so probably about a third of all the businesses run by the famine Irish were saloons. Another quarter were groceries. And then they ran just about every other kind of business you could imagine.
And you were able to really reconstruct where these people were, where the Irish were coming from, what town in Donegal, for example, the peddlers were coming from, and what town others were coming from. That you have this incredible level of detail from those archival sources.
Yes, that's one of the reasons I'm very excited to have some Irish readership for this book, because those names don't mean very much to Irish American readers who've for the most part lost touch with exactly where in Ireland their ancestors were from. But yes, that's the great thing about the bank records, because the bank would ask you exactly where in Ireland you were from, not just the county and not just the parish, but the very town or townland. And so we know, for instance, that the majority of Irish immigrants who became peddlers in New York came just from one part of Donegal, which was Killybegs. And then you see things like charcoal peddlers. Another group came mostly from Tyrone and one parish in Tyrone. Exactly. And so there was this networking involved where people did work in New York and America that they had never done in Ireland, but they got trained in that by previous immigrants from the same place. When you would emigrate and arrive, you'd go find the person from your parish or townland who had come before you and asked them, can you find me work? And they'd say, well, I've become a peddler here. I'll set you up to be a peddler too. And so you have these networks in that regard. One town in Kerry was the source of most of the people who worked in the gas house, in the big gas house in New York, a town of just 500 people because, again, of this networking.
And a lot of praise for them, those that became clerks or agents or civil servants, you know, were praised for the quality of their work. And it shows that there are these other routes that people took that perhaps we're not so aware of. For example, you have a whole chapter on the saloon keepers, and I would never have pictured the Irish going into that profession.
That's so interesting, because in America, that's the stereotype of the 19th century Irish immigrant. Yeah, the saloon keeping was really considered the best business an Irish immigrant could go into. It was considered the peak of success if you could open your own saloon. Saloon keepers were the most respected members of the Irish American community, not just because of their financial success, but also because of their connections to the non-Irish world. The saloon keeper by necessity was involved in New York politics. And that involvement in politics meant a lot for the Irish immigrants because let's say you became sick and you couldn't work to support your family. The local saloon keeper would lend you some money until you were better. The saloon keeper would send a doctor to help you heal and pay for it himself. The saloon keeper also could help you get a job if the job you had wasn't a good one or you lost your job. The saloon keeper had the connections to the city government that allowed you to get a job working for the city. And that could be something like a street sweeper or street paver, but it could be a really good job like a policeman, which paid very well, didn't have any seasonal unemployment, and provided a stepping stone often up the political ladder for those who had political aspirations.
And did you really see here the making of Irish New York? To what extent did they make or remake the state and the city in their image?
There are a lot of ways in which the Irish remake the city in their image and the nation. In particular, as you mentioned at the beginning, one of the things the Irish are able to do is through their economic success and their rise up the socioeconomic ladder, they're able to prove to Americans, to redefine for Americans what the American dream meant. That was a term that hadn't yet been defined, this idea that anyone can succeed, anyone can strike it rich in America. Up until the famine Irish come, Americans had believed that was really only the case for people who came to America with some money and with education. But the famine Irish, after a generation in America, proved that no matter how poor you were, no matter how lacking in education you were, no matter how discriminated against you were, that anyone could succeed and anyone could be a financial success in America. And that really changed the way that all Americans looked at their country and how they conceived of the American dream.
Well, it's a brilliant new study, and there's plenty here for us here in Ireland as well as for the Irish Americans in the United States. Tyler, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
The book is called Plentiful Country, The Great Potato Famine and the Making of Irish New York, published in hardback by Arud. The author, as I say, Tyler Anbinder. And Tyler, a wonderful study. We'll have to bring you back onto the show soon.
Thanks.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
For almost 40 years, DR Power Equipment has been the go-to for homeowners who want professional-level outdoor power equipment. Whether you're managing acres of overgrown fields or just want to have the best lawn on the block, DR Power has everything you need to conquer your piece of the outdoors. Visit drpower.com today to learn more and shop the sale.
Welcome back to Talking History. Marking 50 years of the founding of an LGBTQ rights movement in Ireland, a new book explores the lesser-known stories of the fight for LGBTQ rights beyond decriminalisation and marriage equality. Uncovering 14 key moments that reflect the changing social and cultural landscape of Ireland, the book tells the story of the collective gains, losses, devastation and community rising from the ashes of defeat. The book is called Reeling in the Queers, Tales of Ireland's LGBTQ Past. It's published in paperback by New Island Books. The author is Pádraig Kerrigan. And Pádraig, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, it's a brilliant title, and the pun and the play. And of course, Reeling in the Years is such a part of Irish popular culture and such a brilliant programme. So tell us about the title. Tell us about the thematic approach.
So the title obviously is quite derivative of Ireland's favourite TV show that we all so love. And I suppose what this book does is very much what Reeling in the Years does in terms of looking at a particular year. So I kind of, every year, I've kind of felt to myself that RTE are missing a trick when Pride season comes along and there's no necessary episode dedicated to, you know, the LGBTQ community, of which many events have happened. And that kind of got me thinking, well, there's actually no conduit or no medium through which people are aware of the various things. You know, when we think of this seismic change that has happened within the community in the last 50 years, and I mean, 50 years in history is a very short space of time where a lot happened for the community. From the founding of an Irish gay civil rights movement on the island in 1974 to marriage equality in 2015. These, and again, the history of that often just looks at these watershed moments. But within that, I kind of felt to myself, often when we lionized a history like this, we lose the ordinary people that did really extraordinary things at the core of that. And let me tell you, while the book only has 14 stories, it is 14 in a rich kaleidoscope of a huge history. So what the aim of that book was, and why I named it Reeling in the Queers, was to literally reel some of these people into the mainstream historical narrative that haven't necessarily gotten their dues and did a lot of amazing things to enact a huge range of change socially, culturally, and politically.
And you capture that so brilliantly in the book. And I think that is so important, to tell the story of the ordinary people involved in the movement, because I think it is hard to so much has changed, and so much has changed for the better. It's hard to remember just how dark and difficult it would have been 50 years ago, because it's not until 1993 that homosexual acts are decriminalized. So this is a time when there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of bigotry, there's a lot of prejudice, there's a lot of suspicion, and it's a dangerous time to be gay.
Very much. And I mean, that is pretty much why there was a movement towards establishing an Irish gay rights movement across the island. People were feeling a particular way about their sexuality, and what they were seeing in the media was either derision, overt homophobia, and we have to be quite blatant about the fact that many of these people were living under the climate of criminality from the Criminal Law Amendment Act 1885. So within this context, and within this climate of oppression, people needed to know where communities were. So in that sense, the Irish Gay Rights Movement that came together in 1974 indexically wanted to demonstrate to the nation across both sides of the border that there was a community there for people to go to. So within that sense, you see a lot of, for example, in the early Pride movement, for example, Pride establishes post-Stonewall. So Stonewall riots were a series of riots that took place in New York in June 1969 that were the community and representing the community standing up to oppression. This then becomes a symbol of Pride the year after, when activists on the East Coast of America said, we need to commemorate these riots and ensure that people do not forget about our community. They then establish Pride as the first theme of what was then the Christopher Street Liberation Parade. And from that, gay pride emerged and quickly swept across Europe and the Western world. And you see in 1974, the very first demonstration of Irish gay pride. And this comes in response to Norway and the Norwegian activists looking at the criminal laws that are still in place in Ireland and saying, we're going to show some solidarity to our Irish queer brothers and sisters, and we are going to hold a protest at a British embassy in Norway. So they held this protest, solidarity with the Irish gay community, and therein influenced by this, the sexual liberation movement and the early Irish gay civil rights movement in Ireland said, well, let's hold our own protest. So they went to the walked from the British embassy to the Department of Foreign Affairs on St. Stephen's Green, holding signs saying homosexuals are revolting. And this in and of itself was a reaction to the criminality, the oppression, and shedding light in a community that is there. Pride then becomes a symbol in Ireland of showing we are here, we are well, we are happy. And if you join us, you can also come be well and happy and have a great time. So even though there is a lot of darkness at this time, there is a hell of a lot of queer joy as well. And there's a hell of a lot of good light amongst the shadow.
And an awful lot of fun in the book as well. And you also talk about the emergence of the world's first ever gay boy band in Ireland.
That is a particularly interesting fact that I like to tell people, where I'm kind of saying to them, did you know that Ireland has the first ever gay boy band in the world? I've yet to be correct on that matter, and I have researched that. But yeah, I mean, this emerged interestingly in the 1990s. And it came as a brainchild of an idea from Junior Larkin. Junior was a drag queen in the George, very much prominent on the gay scene, and Junior was setting up a magazine, and he wanted to get an interview with Boyzone, because Boyzone had become very popular in the gay community during this period. And as a result, he said, well, if I get an interview with Boyzone for my magazine, this is going to be great press and a lot of people are going to see it. So from that, he approached some PR representative of the kind of band's camp, and they denied every interview. He got really pissed off with this and kind of went, they have a huge gay following. Their song Love Me For A Reason is an anthem in the Parliament Inn, which was a gay venue at the time, and they're not necessarily acknowledging the fan base that are very loyal to them. So in that sense, he said flippantly to a friend, geez, we need to set up some sort of gay boy band. That friend then ran with it and said, well, yes, set it up, call it Gay Zone. And he went, oh, actually, there's an idea there. So he then held calls for open auditions for any gay guy who wants to join a boy band. They're setting up this gay band, and 70 people showed up. And from that, the band was called Four Guys. But just before he landed on the final lineup, five of the guys who appeared at the audition actually ended up blending really well together. And he said, okay, there's a band there. He goes, but damn, I have already selected a name, Four Guys. So all of a sudden, there's a band called Four Guys with five guys in it. And lots of people internationally felt that the Irish just couldn't count. So this is like a really interesting response at the time, because bear in mind, this is not the early 1990s. We're talking 1995, 1996, when this band comes together. The Irish pop scene is absolutely hopping. Boyzone, Bewitched, there's a moment happening there. But also bear in mind, the broader international pop scene has zero gay people who are out of the closet. I think George Michael comes in 1997. Boy George comes out as bisexual, not fully as gay at this point. And it's quite a brave thing to do for five young Irish guys to get into a band and actually declare themselves publicly as an out, proud gay boy band. That band nearly made it. They got a near record deal in London with an associate of Take That's manager, and almost made it, but just through varying different reasons around management and just personal decisions in the band, it kind of just didn't necessarily go anywhere. So they were a year together, they travelled around the country, and they were brought on air, told on various radio shows that they were disordered, unruly, and trying to completely destroy the good children of Ireland. And they were just like, hey, we're just five guys singing camp songs. We're not here to do anything. So,
and that's something that you do see in the book, that there are attempts to kind of control, to censor the culture, to keep a lid on it. And again, these kind of fears about, you know, how the world would be contaminated if they just expose people to any of this.
One of my favourite moments from the book that speaks directly to that is Terry Blanche. So Terry Blanche was one of the first lesbian activists who I personally don't think she gets her dues in the history, so which is why I've included her in the book and dedicated to her. She's since passed. But Terry, when she was a young girl, she said to me in an interview that she wanted to find some sense of her lesbian self somewhere in the world. But everyone was just basically saying, Phelim said lesbians just die, that they don't have good lives, they're miserable and they're lonely. So one day in a feminist magazine, she saw Radcliffe Hall, The Well of Loneliness. And she said, ah, that's where I can find a lesbian. So one day, in the hope of finding some sort of positive affirmation of who she was and how she was feeling at 16, she gets the bus into town, to Dublin city centre, and goes into a bookshop. She nervously paces outside one of the bookstores in town and eventually builds up the courage to go in. She goes up to a sales assistant, a bookseller, and just says, hi, have you got The Well of Loneliness in stock? The bookseller puts her books down on the table, looks her up and down and says, we don't sell those kinds of books here. And just in that utter moment, Terry just felt pure shame over that. Now, at this point, The Well of Loneliness by Radcliffe Hall, just fun fact, was censored by the Censorship of Publications Board in Ireland. But at this point, it had been, the censorship clause had been removed. But even at that, you see these kind of very overt, silent forms of censorship that aren't necessarily official, where a bookseller refuses to sell a book to somebody because of their own kind of political dispensation and resistance and homophobia, essentially. So yes, throughout the book, there are moments of control just like that, often through overt mechanisms of the state, like the Censorship of Publications Board, but also quietly through people who don't necessarily want to or agree with the homosexual lifestyle, as I say in inverted air quotes. One other example of that I might share is our current president, Michael D. Higgins. So in 1995, the Health Information or the Health Education Bureau were developing a series of AIDS information campaigns. Broadcasters in Ireland were very reticent to broadcast campaigns for a number of reasons. One being that they represented a same-sex couple, two gay guys. And because of this resistance, Michael D. Higgins declared publicly as Minister for Culture, Gael, Talk and Communications at the time, which he had kind of that portfolio and power to do so. He said, if you don't broadcast them, I will force you to do so. So don't make me and don't challenge me.
Good old Michael D.
So you see all of these forms of different kinds of censorship emerging throughout this period.
How do you think we should give these people the credit they deserve? That your book does tell the story of ordinary people who did extraordinary things, who did help change Ireland for the better, who aren't properly remembered, who haven't gotten that recognition. But how should we give them the recognition?
I suppose it's through exercises like a book such as this. And this is only a starting point and a stepping stone. It's by looking to the cracks of our histories. And it's as historians, as people, looking towards the stories that we have and looking for those fissures and those gaps and pulling at those gaps and threads and ensuring that we actually look towards a bigger picture. That, and again, it's no disrespect to the big hitters of the movement. You know, we owe a lot to the likes of Senator David Norris, the Yes Equality during the marriage equality referendum and the campaigns there, all fantastic people. But even within these campaigns, for example, there is a lot of people that did great work. So one such example of pulling at that thread and looking at that gap would be in the case of David Norris, right? When we refer to David Norris, we would say he brought the case to the European Court of Human Rights and decriminalised homosexuality, and we are all forever grateful to him. But, you know, he was part of a big team. There was a lot of people then that had to ensure, once the case went through at the European Court of Human Rights, that gay law reform would happen. One of those people, and is a personal hero of mine in the movement, is Phil Moore. Phil Moore was the mother of a gay son, Dermot Moore, and one day, Phil Moore was sitting in her kitchen, eating her famous lentil soup, and Dermot walked into the kitchen and said, "Ma'am, I have something to tell you." Her mind raced with endless possibilities as to what this could be, and he said, "Ma'am, I'm gay." So Phil, at that immediate moment, said, "It's a phase, you'll grow out of it." And then over the next few weeks, she went to herself, "My God, I cannot believe that's the response that I gave my son." And she subsequently set herself about educating herself with regards to gay life and whatnot. So one day she went with her son Dermot to the Hirschfeld Centre, which was a LGBTQ centre running in Temple Bar from 1979 to 87. And in there, her heart broke because Dermot introduced her to all of his friends, and Phil saw the devastation, the young gay people that were left homeless, that were beaten by their parents, that were living on the streets, that the Hirschfeld was their only home. She said, "This is not right." So she subsequently set up with Patricia Kilroy Parents Inquiry, which became this organisation to help parents of queer children understand sexuality, essentially. A massively useful service. And all of a sudden, Phil becomes a doctor on call, where parents are ringing her up going, "My son has just come out, my daughter's just come out, what do I do?" And becomes a hero for the movement. But anyways, moving back to decriminalisation very briefly, once the case at the European courts was decided and Ireland was mandated to remove the criminal legislation, Phil becomes really active in the gay law reform movement. The Gay and Lesbian Equality Network, Kieran Rose, Susie Byrne, Christopher Robson are all really focused on getting gay law reform, full law reform across the line. So the work wasn't just done with David Norris's case. Phil Moore becomes really active in this sense, and she goes into Maura Gagan Quinn in a final meeting, who was then the Minister for Justice deciding this, and spoke to her mother to mother and just said, "Look, listen, I know you're a mother. I'm a mother too. This is my child and this is the life that he has lived. He is very happy. There is nothing wrong with this." And Maura Gagan Quinn to this day says that Phil Moore and that conversation with Phil Moore changed her life and completely changed her perspective. So subsequently, full gay law reform was given. And I think that's just kind of what we need to do with these kinds of queer histories, is not just to look at the big key moments of Ireland decriminalised in 1988 and then subsequently 93. There's a hell of a lot that happens in between those moments, and beautiful moments at that, where a nice mother of a gay son goes to the Minister for Justice, has a word in her ear, and changes Ireland for gay people forever. I think there's something in that.
Well, there's lots of beautiful moments like that in this book. It's a brilliant study, Reeling in the Queers, Tales of Ireland's LGBTQ Past. It's published in paperback by New Island Books. The author is Pádraig Kerrigan. And Pádraig, that's been absolutely brilliant. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much.
Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and Hannah Flam on research. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.
DR Power Equipment is the industry leader in field and brush mowers. Their full line of machines are designed to clear acres of tough weeds, woody brush, and saplings up to 3 inches thick, hour after hour, year after year. Just one mow, and you'll agree nothing stops a DR. Visit drpower.com to learn more and shop the sale today.